You guys ready to do this?
Welcome to the Cap Space Wins Cups podcast.
The Dragon!
Double overtime, and the Vancouver Canucks are going to the Stanley Cup Final.
They are simply put the two greatest Canucks of all time. Please welcome Daniel and Henrik.
Elias Pettersson put it into sport mode. With Hughes ahead, here's a break. It's Bo Horvat. Beagle to stick. Scores! Game winner for the captain. Scores! Chris Tanev.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Cap Space Wins Cups podcast, episode 78 on the Area 51 Sports Network. I am your host, Hassan Ahmed. I am joined alongside, as per usual, my twin brother, Hassan Ahmed. How's it going, buddy?
Good, man. How are you?
And, of course, by Hussein, who's the Hussein Ahmed. Who's what's going on, buddy?
What's up, boys?
And our man, Andy Purr. Andy, how's it going, my man?
Doing good. How about you guys?
I'm doing all right. So we have not reported in 3 weeks. We've had some technical issues with the soundboard. Producer Ace is failed to remedy the situation so far. So we're on Zoom here. We're going to see what's going wrong there and see if we can get back to our regular setup. But that's why we haven't been with you guys for the last couple of weeks. But we're back, and the Canucks have been weird, I would say. They had some ups. They had some downs. Today we're recording it on Family Day, the 21st of February. So the Canucks are taking on the Seattle Kraken tonight. But they took out the Ducks. Yeah, of course. Yeah, battle of two Pacific Division Titans. But yes, they did get pretty humiliated by the Ducks on home ice on Saturday night at Hockey Night in Canada, going down 5-0 in the first period. Seems like I'm shocked that that's happened more than once this season. Shocked. And of course they had the game against San Jose where they pulled out the 5-4 win after blowing a 2-goal lead and then giving up a goal in the literal last second of play. So the Canucks are still one game over 500 right now. They're in a playoff race, if you ask some people on this podcast. I think the rest of us might be looking at what contracts they can dump. And as the trade deadline is approaching, anyone else feel weird that the trade deadline is like so late in March because of the Olympic break? I feel like every week I'm like, oh, the trade deadline's getting close, and you look at the calendar and it's still like a month away.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, that is weird. I've been ready for the trade deadline for like 2 weeks now.
They should have just moved it back now when they found out the Olympic players were, or the NHL guys weren't going to the Olympics.
Yeah, honestly, they should have. Like, I agree. It's I don't even really want to watch the games anymore. Like, most of them are boring, and then get interested because you can see how badly the Canucks fuck up. Like then San Jose, I know we'll talk about that game, but that game was boring for the first period. And then the third period became interesting because somehow they let the worst team in the league, one of them, go the entire length of the ice in 5 seconds and score.
You saw the clip of that goal, right? Like there was 6 seconds left or 5 seconds left, and Brent Burns was at his own blue line. And Somehow in that period of time, they've got a shot from right in front of our net.
Yeah, honestly, it looks like amateur hour out there. So I'm ready for the trade deadline. Let's see some trades. I want to find out where JT Miller goes. I want to see where Tyler Mott gets in return. Like, I don't know. Games are kind of boring.
Bo Horvat, maybe? Bo Horvat? It's been a tough few weeks for Bo Horvat.
It's been a tough few weeks for Bo Horvat. Honestly, like, I wonder if he's injured or if there's something going on because he's, what is his seventh year, I think? Sixth year?
Working theory is his wife is pregnant, you know, distracting him. He's worried about his wife, worried about his newborn baby on the way, you know?
I mean,
he's got the new dad jitters. And then when the baby's out, he's going to see a lot of goals coming.
His wife is pregnant, but I think, did she not give birth to their first son during the bubble, or around the bubble time?
Yeah, right. I think she had given birth already,
Okay.
He was already born before he left. Then he went to join the bubble. Like when just after a few days he was born. Then you see playing his best. You baby bump there. You got to wait for the baby to come out though.
Then your first round podcast.
No, but I don't know. I think. Sorry, go ahead, Andy.
I was going to say, what you're saying is once she gives birth, he's going to become a beast again.
No, exactly. Like just that. That's put it down. Put money on the board for that. Tell me. Or that multi-point game, multi-goal game, first day after the baby's born.
On a serious note, though, about Horvat, I wanted to say something because near the beginning of the season, he was one of the more consistent players for the Canucks, especially when Pettersson and Besser weren't really going. He was, remember at the beginning of the season, he was scoring all those goals when the Canucks were really out of games trying to drag them back in. But you look at his totals now, and it's been kind of a meager season for Horvat. I mean, Horvat, I think we all expect him to be around a 60-point player, right? And he's been closer to a 45, 50-point guy this year. So it's been definitely an off season for him, but his troubles have definitely been kind of exacerbated over the last 2 weeks defensively. And, you know, there's nothing really going from offensively right now either. So, yeah. And then, you know, obviously a lot of the trade talk around Horvat kind of heats up, you know, when his play is not so good.
I think that, you know, even if Horvat's not playing well or whatever, or if he's, you know, having a down season, I mean, I think it's pretty clear that what we've seen from this Magic group right now is that they're not really entertaining offers on Horvat for the time being. And I think we've kind of outlined that on this podcast, you know, for reasons why, you know, besides on-ice value for why you might not want to trade a guy like Bo Horvat. And also, like, you know, given his recent play, he's probably not going to be demanding the contract that, you know, we necessarily think that he might have gotten a couple of years ago. You know, even if Horvat got to free agency right now, like, what do you really think he would be getting?
I mean, I think he'd still be pretty expensive if he was a free agent right at this minute.
I bet somewhere in the sevens, I'd say. Depending on the time, too.
You guys think Horvat, then JT Miller would be looking around $7 million with his next contract, don't you think?
I think JT's like an 8, and I think Bo Horvat would be like a 7. That's what I think. But I think Bo Horvat, before this year happened, I would have guessed that if he was to go to free agency, he could get up to 8 probably by another team just because of the reputation he already has. You know, like before they said no to the Olympics, he was on the radar for Team Canada. He's a captain of his team. You already know NHL GMs love overpaying for leadership. I mean, like, say what you will, he scores goals, he's a good power play guy. He has a reputation for being two-way. So, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised even now on the off year, he still gets up to like 7.5 from a team on open market.
Yeah,
I mean, no, I
agree. Like, you think of Horvat, and the thing that's kind of weird to me is that you look at all the players he's played with, and they've been Louis Erickson and Marcus Granlund and all these, you know, borderline NHL players, and he's got 60 points and a bunch of assists. And now he's got two legitimate wingers and Pearson and Garland or, you know, Miller, whoever he's played with, good NHL players, and he has no assists, which is why his point production's down. So, it's, I don't know, like, it's kind of weird. Like, going into the year, you would have expected him to get 60 points easily, and now we're going to be lucky if he gets 50, which, you know, not a huge difference, but the money difference between being a 50-point player and a 60-point player is significant, right? So, I don't know. Something's wrong with him, but it's not good, and hopefully we can figure it out for next year because not having a 2C is a massive problem for the Canucks.
Horvat was one of those guys who used to play better with, like, worse players.
Worse players. Yeah.
Like, that is actually, like, if that, I don't know if there's actually, like, anything merit to that, but it seems like when he has other good players on the line, he's, like, more happy to kind of defer to them and just be around or try to work into them more. I feel like when Horvat's on his game, he's more concerned about just playing direct and getting shots on goal.
And getting the puck to the net?
Yeah, whereas, like, right now, he's just trying to. I don't really know what he's doing in the offensive zone. I don't see much happening.
The problem is Horvat's not doing anything right now. That's the problem. The stat line was literally empty against the Ducks. He didn't have a shot on goal. Didn't even throw a single hit.
He just went face-off.
You know, like, that's it. Just the face-offs are the thing in this category right now. Like, he's not generating anything. Like, for a guy being paid as a top six forward and captain of your team, he's got to have more of a bottom line. Even on a bottom line, they got to be doing something out there, right? Like, with the amount of ice time you get.
Yeah, and defensively, he's been pretty. Like, it's been a pretty tough scene for him recently. I mean, penalty kill. I mean, who on the Canucks penalty kill isn't getting shredded? But, you know, you have to look at Bo Horvat as one of the big guys who comes out of the boards every time they're killing. And then even 5-on-5 defensively, he looks like he's getting caved a lot out there recently. So I mean, it's been pretty bad for
Horvat should not be killing penalties. I gotta say, man, looks completely lost out there. Like, I know, like, all these new guys are trying to on the penalty kill, but like, it is not looking good for Bo on the penalty kill right now. No. I mean, Petey's been much better on him on the penalty kill than so. Yeah, I mean,
I will never understand why Bo Horvat cannot kill penalties. He's got the perfect prototype, the kind of guy you'd think would be like a great penalty killer, but he just can't seem to figure it out at the NHL level. I don't know why.
Yeah, he's huge. He's fast. He wins faceoffs, and he can kill penalties. It doesn't make sense. It seems like the perfect.
Why can this guy not kill penalties? If you want to build a perfect penalty killer, you'd be like, oh yes, all the skills that Bo Horvat has.
I would love to see Pettersson kill penalties more often now, though. I feel like when Bruce Boudreau first came here, he was really giving, like, you know, Pod Colson, Pettersson, even Quinn Hughes, like, a lot more of a chance to kill penalties. And then I think recently he's kind of getting into the Travis Green syndrome here. I'd say, like, the last, like, 10, 12 games, like, every time, it's, you know, it's Lamb, McCull, it's Maude, it's Miller, it's just the regulars, Dickinson. And, you know, Pettersson's only coming out there for the last, like, 20 seconds. If the Canucks are lucky to not give up a goal on the penalty kill, like, I still don't understand why we're not going to put Pettersson out there. And I think recently he's been playing terrific anyway. He looks back to normal, in my opinion. So I don't see why not give him a chance on the penalty kill. That's pretty much gone back to the same as it was under Travis Green, now here with Bruce Boudreau.
Yeah, I agree. Like, at this point, you know, the penalty kill kind of got a little bit of a bump at the beginning of Boudreau tenure, but they're still giving up like two goals, maybe three goals a game, at least one for sure. So why are we trying to figure out who can and can't kill penalties? Just roll the next two players up on forward and on defense. Like, you know, worst case, they still get scored on. You're in the same position you are now when you're trying to figure out who's a good penalty killer. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I don't understand this. I mean, I get it from a coach's perspective. You're trying to win, but from an organizational perspective, like, who cares if Tyler Mott gets 2 minutes of PK time next game? Unless they kill the penalty, it doesn't matter, you know? So whatever, let Jason Dickinson and Brock Besser kill a penalty together. See what happens. Worst case, yeah, position, they still give up a goal.
Yeah.
I can't disagree with that, Andy. Like, what the penalty kill has been like. I mean, okay, I know this is not an imperfect Canucks team and not a well-constructed roster. We all agree on that.
Yeah.
But if the Canucks penalty kill was competent, the Canucks would be in a playoff spot right now. Like, it is literally costed them this season. And your strategy is, let's just keep doing the same thing that put us in 32nd in the entire league?
Yeah.
Like, why not figure out at least what we have going forward long term? And for God's sake, why does Hamnick even get on the ice or on the penalty kill? What is he doing out there? What is he doing out there? My God, he is, like, so lost out there. Contract, it's just...
I was just going to touch on what you said there. You know, you just said that the Canucks would be in a playoff spot if the penalty kill was just... even like league average here. And that's like counting in how bad the power play's been too. Like, the special teams on this team have been awful. And say what you will about Jim Benning and what he did in 8 years here, but going into this season, there's no way you look at the talent, or at least what I thought the talent was in the top six, and say this team should not have at least the top 10 power play in the NHL. Like, I cannot comprehend why this power play is as bad as it is. With the amount of players they have that they can interchange with it, that might be part of the reason why.
Well, Ace actually has a good theory on why the power play doesn't work. Yeah. I know we've talked about it off air a few times, Ace. Did you want to maybe touch on that in the podcast?
You're gonna have to remind me what I said. I make a lot of good points, so sometimes you know what I'm gonna watch
that. Okay, the best percentage after to get the blue line.
Oh right, yeah. Thanks for reminding me. No, but I mean,
that's a great segue. Really professional. Oh, Ace has a great point in this. You're going to have to tell me what it was.
No, but I know a lot of people harp on the zone entries for the power play, but it's not necessarily the zone entries, because like, they are able to gain the blue line. It's just once they've gained the blue line, they have a very low success rate of doing anything like making a pass or getting a shot on goal. Like, the key, that was the point of the zone entry, right? Is getting set up or getting a shot. And they don't really do that. If you watch the power play, like, they'll get over the line and then, you know, Miller or Hughes or Horvat will most likely, they'll either throw a blind pass cross ice that's going to get like a bad pass that will get picked off and thrown down the ice, or they're going to get checked and then it's going to get thrown down the ice again. You just waste too much time trying to get back in and make a successful maneuver to get the puck in a position where you can start shooting it from. And then, Case, you say this as well, is that they are kind of I don't know, obsessed or married to just working the puck up high way too often. They love keeping the puck up high between Miller and Hughes there. I mean, I would like to see them work the cycle a little bit more down low. I mean, this is a team that had the Sedins for 20 years. Like, you would think that cycling the puck is something that we know is a good way to keep the puck on the power play. So I don't know why they don't try using that more often. You have some bigger, stronger bodies down there in Miller and Horvat who can work on the puck retrieval. And then, you know, it would also sort of promote your team to get play more direct and get more pucks towards the front of the net instead of just constantly playing catch up high and looking for a perfect one-timer.
That's the biggest – that's the other problem, right? Like, if you're playing from down low, you have such little time to shoot that when you get the puck in a dangerous scoring opportunity high slot area, you shoot quickly. And that's, you know, a reason Horvat's had a lot of success in that bumper spot is he just had quick release. You know, with Pettersson and Hughes and Miller up high, Miller sometimes, you know, can unload a few, but Pettersson seems to constantly be waiting for that double clutching on the one-timer. Like, just – it doesn't have to be the perfect shot. It just has to be a shot, right? Like, we got to – you're not going to score if you don't shoot. And, you know, there has been times where the Canucks are maybe down in games and they play with some more urgency and then they throw a bunch of stuff to the net on power play and then they score. But that has to be a constant thing. It can't be, okay, we're down 4-0. Now let's, you know, we've got a power play. Let's really just throw everything on net.
I completely agree. And then Quinn Hughes is the muffin man from up there. And he seems to be the only person who listens to Bruce Boudreau in terms of like shooting more on the power play. And it just go, he's got Alex Edler syndrome. It's going into the shin pads.
Left. I think Quinn Hughes just needs to work on that, yeah.
Yeah, that's something. And like you were saying, just shoot it in more. I mean, like, you look at the last game against Anaheim there when Pettersson scores on the one-timer. I mean, I thought when I was watching it live, I was like, this is not going to be a good pass. Like, it was on his back foot entirely. And he still, you know, he just lets it go because the team's down 4-0. And what you know, it goes in, goes top shelf. Like, I think that's also something Pettersson just needs to, like, accept. You know, you're kind of the trigger man on the power play. You have the best shot out of anyone on the ice here. Like, you know, don't be afraid to shoot it more.
I mean, also, like, you saw later in that game, once Pettersson started playing a bit better, when he started engaging physically, throwing some more hits, he just started shooting everything, you know? Like, I would like to see Pettersson play like that more often, because you are the best player on the team. So, you know, I mean, people say JT Miller, but I mean, Pettersson is the best player on the team. You have to start being direct and taking the game by the horns. You can't just be, you know, deferring to somebody else or always looking for a pass or a perfect play, you know? You can't always find that perfect play, but you're such a skilled player. Like, even if it's not, you know, the perfect opportunity.
If it's 85% play, not 100% play, there's still a great chance make it goes in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, like, I don't want to look at Pettersson's box score at the end of the night and then show that it has, you know, three attempts and one's on net. Like, he has to, like, you look at Leon Draisaitl, Austin Matthews, all these guys. You go and look at their shot attempts. Like, Leon Draisaitl shoots the puck like a maniac. Like, he has, like, 18 attempts in the game and, like, 11 of them are on net. Matthews is the same thing. Like, I want to see that from Pettersson. Like, whether it's on the power play, whether it's 5-on-5, like, heck, even if it's shorthanded, like, he has to shoot the puck more.
Yeah, for sure. Like, I think they're trying – it almost seems like they're trying to make – like, set up and do a power play by a traditional power play means. You know what I mean? Like, set up, pass it around, look for an open shot. Like, you have five guys against four. If you can go 4-on-2 up the ice and score off the rush – do it. If you can put three guys in the corner to fish the puck out and go 1-on-1 in front of the net, do it. Like, the point of a power play is to score. It doesn't have to look like quote-unquote traditional way with a point shot and a rebound. Like, who cares? Get the puck in the net. Like you said, if you need to shoot it 17 times in 10 seconds before you score, go ahead. You know, I don't care as a fan as long as it goes in.
Yeah. No.
I think, I mean, and we've said this so many times about the kind of power play and the stagnation and the lack of movement and how static it is. With everybody just staring there, you know, the players are kind of the side of their, you know, 5-6, you know, 6x5 block of the ice where they just constantly stay within that area and nobody ever moves out of their, you know, designated zone. And that's made the Canucks power play really predictable. And I feel like they're so married to it that they don't even, the players are so robotic that they're not even trying to look for a play. They just are like, okay, I want to, you know, this is a play. And if it's not that, it's, you know, option B, and if it's not that, it's option C, and if it's not that, then I don't know what I'm doing. You know, it's Miller to Hughes, Hughes to Pettersson, shot, or it's, you know, Miller down low to whoever's on the goal line to Horvat in the slot, or, you know, something like that. And it's very rarely does that ever work, or it's them just, Miller and Pettersson, just, like, force-feeding those Royal Road cross-ice passes when there's clearly no lane. And it's just so frustrating to watch as a fan because you see other teams, like, whip the puck around on the power play against the Canucks through the middle of the ice, and it seems like it's the most difficult pass in the world for the Canucks to complete.
Yeah, no, it's frustrating. Like, you know, the whole special teams is penalty kill goes out, you know, for sure they're giving up one basically every game. You're surprised if they don't. And the power play goes out and you're surprised if they score in a game. So right away, when you look at those numbers, you're automatically down 1-0 going into every game. And for a team that's in the lower end of scoring in the league, that's very hard to catch up with.
Yep. 100% agree. Did anyone have a soft on power play before I was going to kind of move on to something else here?
Yeah, the other thing I want to say on the power play, we saw the today for the Kraken game on Monday. Why the fuck is Jason Dickinson on the power play? The guy's got 3 goals in the year. And
does he have 3? I thought he had 2.
I don't know, 2. Anyways, the point is you know, the number of points he has on one hand. Like, you talk about offense. When I think offense on the team, there's literally nobody that I think of lower than Jason Dickinson. Kyle Burrows brings more threat of an offense than Jason Dickinson.
And let me tell you guys, players who have more points than Jason Dickinson this year. Juho Lamico, Luke Shen, Jason, Mott, Tyler Myers, Puck Golden, and the rest of the top 6 guys, and Hickman Larson.
So. Tymor. The entire fourth line has more points than this guy?
Tymor has a Tymor and Dickinson are tied.
Pardon me. Your fourth line winger has tied with him in points. Pardon me.
But Highmore's missed like 20 games too. That's
Andrew Brad Hunt is also tied with him. And Kyle Burrows is almost as many goals.
Oh my god. Yeah, that's pretty bad. But don't disrespect Joel Lamacall. He's a known goal scorer around here these days. Okay.
Yeah, like
it's
just embarrassing. It's frustrating. Like, why are we watching games where Jason Dickinson and Brad Hunt are getting opportunities over Hoglander? Or Podkolzin, or even like you said, who's Juho Lamico, Tyler Mott, like guys who have actually shown that they know how to put the puck in the net. Jason Dickinson doesn't even look like he knows where the offensive zone is.
Or Jason. I'll take Jason over Dickinson these days on the power play, man.
I still probably dislike Jason more, but it's the conversation's getting very close.
Well, the fact that
we've talked about it, that he knows at least like on a power play, he could play in front of the net, like he would know what to do.
Yeah.
Gotten a few goals and go off him. You know, like Dickinson can't even do that.
Well, I mean, I don't know. What would you guys want? You know, how we're just talking about, like, you know, what's wrong with the first unit, especially for that lack of movement. Like, I, for one, I'm kind of tired of seeing the same 5 go over the boards. I want to see Connor Garland on the first unit now. The guy's a spin cycle every time he gets on the ice. I don't see why a power play that lacks movement. And we have a guy who literally never stops moving his feet. I would say he's a pretty good passer. He's got shown some good finish on the power play this season anyway. He's played a power play one his entire NHL career in Arizona.
Garland should be on the first unit instead of Besser for sure.
Yeah,
Besser has been.
He's not been good on.
Besser has been awful, and against in the Anaheim game, Brock Besser was terrible the whole game. Like, I don't know what the guy is doing right now. Like, I have been very disappointed with Brock Besser's season as a whole. Like, there have been flashes and streaks of success, but overall, I don't know what the man is doing out there. Garland was awesome last game. Was the only player who was moving his feet and forechecking and actually getting the puck to the net. And you see what happens when you get to that puck to the net. You can score. Like, he had that, you know, the backhand from the goal line. And he kind of caught Gibson napping and he scored. Like, those are the kind of things you need. And clearly whatever is happening on the first unit isn't working right now. And we gave up a lot to get Garland. The Canucks traded a huge piece in Dylan Gunther. You know, who's, you know, lighting up the WHL right now. You know, who would look great in the prospect pipeline for a team that has, you know, no prospects anywhere. And, you know, we have Garland instead right now. We keep bumping him to the second power blade or out of the top 6. Like, I don't understand what the hesitation is with getting this guy more ice time.
The other thing about Garland, too, is, like, you look at a lot of his goals. He scores them in and around the crease area, right? Mm-hmm. Which, when you're on a power play and the Canucks don't really have a one-shot shooter, I mean, other than Besser, but if he's not going to be on PP1 anyways, like, you're going to need those rebounds and garbage enclosed goals. So why not put the guy who seemed to not be afraid to go to the net and try to score from there out on the power play and see what happens?
Yep. I mean, I don't understand why they don't – I know Horvat has some success in the bumper spot, but I don't understand why they don't ever try Horvat from net front instead of the bumper.
Yeah, it's the best puck retrieval on the team.
He's one of the best aspects of his game is puck retrieval. And second of all, like, his coach and junior said that of all the players he's coached throughout his career at the London Knights, Horvat was the second best net front presence in the power play he's ever had. And he said the first was Corey Perry. So, I mean, I think that he's obviously got some sort of skill set that would help him get in front of the net. So I don't understand why you don't just try a different look instead of just trying the same thing again and again.
Yeah, especially considering that like lots of teams have picked up on Bo Horvat in the bumper too. It's like one of the like last resort options these days for their power play anyway. That pass always seems to be cut off by other teams. I don't see why not. I'd like to see maybe like even like a guy like JT Miller in the bumper too, I think. Like I wouldn't mind throwing Miller in the bumper, maybe Garland and Pettersson as your half walls instead, and just see how that works.
Yeah, I mean, might as well. Like we said with the PK, if power play is not working, so what's the harm in trying new things? Like, worst case, they don't score and you're in the same position you were anyways.
Yeah.
Kind of moving off the power play discussion now. For regular 5-on-5 lines, and I know I was kind of talking about Brock Besser and how disappointed I've been with him this season. I think the Canucks need to seriously look now at, you know, Miller, Besser, Garland, and those three guys. You could maybe throw Horvat in that mix, but I think that you need to look at those three or four players and decide, you know, which two of those you want to keep and which two of those need to go. And I think that's a combination of contract, status, age, what you would actually get for that player in return. Because the Canucks need to win those two grades handedly and get back players that are going to be like the shape of the future here. And they cannot, like, I think there's a theory that now the Canucks need to get like a specific type of player here. You know, they need a right shot, this kind of defenseman in this trade. I think the Canucks are pretty terrible everywhere, to be honest. So I think that they need to just get good players, period. Ideally on the blue line, but I think the Canucks have some other holes that they need to be filled ASAP. And I think that they just need to get good assets into the pipeline. So in your opinion, out of those four or three, who would you trade, why, and would you guys agree with my assessment that you need to just get assets in the door, not necessarily worry too much about Dake? You know, everybody's talking about how they want Braden Schneider or Nils Lundqvist. I wouldn't really get too tied up in that. I think if you can get good prospects in the door, do it.
Yeah, I mean, for sure you want to get good players in the door. I think the point of the conversation is if you given an option and the values are similar, you should target this player instead, right? So, I mean, yeah, like if the team says all you're going to get is a goal-scoring winger and a left-shot defenseman from us, you're not going to say no. But if you have an opportunity to find a right-shot defenseman who, you know, is similar value in a trade, I think that's definitely the way they should go because that's the biggest hole on the team, right? But you're right. The thing about getting assets is that you can – nobody says you have to keep those assets and put them in your lineup, right? You can move them again. Or let's say you get Nils Lundqvist. Maybe that makes Jack Rathbone expendable, right? Like you – having assets gives you options. So, yeah, I mean, I think anybody who doesn't wear number 43 should be on the table for a trade. I mean, my ask on certain players would be astronomically through the roof, but 43 is the only person when they ask about Quinn Hughes, I immediately hang up the phone.
Okay, I think I got my answer for what Hayes posed there. For out of those four, I think it's obvious, and I'm pretty sure you're all four or all three of you will agree. JT Miller is obviously one of them. And the other one, I think I made this clear a couple episodes ago that I think I'll move Brock Besser and I'd rather keep Connor Garland just because of the cost certainty. They're around the same age, but I think Garland's on a much more friendly deal. And, you know, we all know Brock Besser's qualifying offer. We know what that's like. And I mean, especially like Hayes was mentioning earlier recently, I have not been impressed with his play anyway. I think he's going to get a haul. And like you said about assets, yeah, I don't think it matters. The Canucks really don't have anything. And especially if you're looking at like, you know, the chance here. I mean, there's a lot of people clamoring that they want to move Bo Horvat. If Bo Horvat's gone, there's not even a second line center on the team. So there's really not a single thing that I would say the Canucks have checked off other than a goalie in Demko, a defenseman in Quinn Hughes, and a center in Pettersson. Anything else we're pretty much lacking in entirely. So I don't mind getting anything back. And the best thing about the assets is that you get the cap space that this team's going to need moving forward.
Yeah, I would say in terms of the type of asset you're bringing in, it really depends on the scale of the rebuild. Because, Andy, I agree that right shot D is, like, the biggest hole. But that's the biggest hole of the team right now. Like, if we start creating some major assets off the team right now, who's to say that, like, you know, the right shot D would still be the biggest issue, depending on how much of the roster you want to strip down? You know what I'm saying? So, from that aspect, I would say I wouldn't get too picky. But, obviously, yes. Like, if I can get a right shot D, I would like that. As far as those guys go, honestly, I would be looking at trading Garland, Messer, and Miller, to be honest with you. And if the right offer came around on Horvat, I would trade him as well.
They're just, you're tearing it down to studs here?
Yeah, going all the way down.
I would just, yeah, blow it up.
Well, I don't understand this idea that the market has about, like, you know, oh, we can't trade this guy. I don't want to trade that guy. Like, the team sucks. So I don't understand. Yeah. Bring back the same 15 players every year. Like, what, you know, changing out the fourth line center and the sixth defenseman isn't going to do anything. So why not explore options?
I agree with that. I was saying I would be calling teams and be like, we got to move Horvat. We got to get Horvat out of here. Like, I'm just saying, if a team called me and said, hey, what do you want for Horvat? I would be like, well, what's your offer? You know, I don't want to hang up the phone. I would hear what you guys got to say, right? Because if somebody's giving you a great haul for Bo Horvat, which I think a team could potentially give you, you would be stupid not to explore the idea of doing that.
Yeah, exactly.
I think Bo Horvat's one of the cases, too. Out of those four players that Hayes said, that I would say, like, almost certainly, value-wise, the Canucks probably win that deal 9 out of 10 times. Whereas if you're moving Brock Besser, I think it might be the other way around. And value-wise, the Canucks probably lose that deal, you know, maybe 7, 8 out of 10 times.
It's hard with Besser's contract status to trade him because of, or in terms of...
Yeah, it's way more complicated.
Way more complicated, I agree.
That's why I'm like, you know, if a team calls you in Garland, they're like, you know?
Yeah, because you know what you have to fit on your...
Okay, but what are you going to get for Garland? Like, how much is a guy working, like, you know, 50-point top six player making four...
I mean, if I had a first-round pick and one of your better prospects, one of your top five prospects in your organization, I think of all those guys there, the minimum you should be getting for all of them is at least first-round draft pick and a prospect. For every single one of the players that we just, those all four of those guys, anything less than that, you wouldn't trade him.
I'd agree with that. Unless, I mean, the only way that becomes less than a first round pick on a prospect, or maybe not less,
having a bad contract.
Yeah, exactly. Like a Dickinson, Pullman, Hamnick. I mean, the list goes on for bad contracts. I think that's the only way.
Well, the thing is that, like, Rutherford has been on record saying that he wants this thing turned around in 2 years, and that's more of his timeline in 2 years. I don't think that all four of those guys are going anywhere. I just think that's a complete non-starter. I think the management group has made it clear what their intentions are, and I think you should be operating with all those parameters. I don't think that those four players are going to be shipped at the door, and there's going to be a 4 or 5 year rebuild because you've signed Demko to a 5 year contract, you've signed Pettersson to a 3 year contract. I don't think, you know, you need to kind of tie your competitive window around those players, or then if they're not going to work out either, get trade down too.
No, yeah, that's what I said too. I said, I mean, like I said, if I was in charge of the Canucks right now, your timeline's got to be the back half of Quinn Hughes' contract and the back half of Demko's contract. They're both fairly long. Quinn Hughes is on the 6 year deal, obviously, Demko on a 5 year deal. You got to be trying to get competitive and, you know, preferably the last 3 years of Demko's, but you know what? If not, let it be the last 2 years. And for Quinn Hughes, it's got to be the last 3 years of that. Because if your timeline doesn't fit in that, the raises both of those players are getting, we're back to the same problem we have right now where, like, those contracts are going to be ridiculous. Like, what can Thatcher Demko even get when this contract's over if he's playing at this level of play? And, like, same thing with Quinn Hughes. Like, he's going to be in Norris talks for years to come. That's got to be the timeline right now. And if it's not in that, then I'm with you, Hayes. It's an entire rebuild, and you got to start from scratch.
Yeah, like, I don't know. That's the thing, right, is the amount of bad contracts and lack of cap space. They're in a position where they can't afford to keep all these good forwards because they've wasted like $30 million on a defense that sucks outside of Quinn Hughes. So unless you can convince somebody to take all the dog shit on defense to open the space to keep all these forwards, like, you know, you're going to have to make a decision. And for me personally, I'd rather not overpay a player who's going to be declining in the next few years in JT Miller. So,
I mean, I think JT Miller is a foregone conclusion at this point that he's going to be traded. Like, I would be...
The list of reasons great. JT Miller is much longer.
I would be extremely shocked if he's still a Canuck at the start of next season.
I was going to agree with that. I think JT Miller is pretty much as good as gone now, but it just depends, you know, when does it happen? Is it at this year's trade deadline? Is it a draft day deal? Is it sometime in the summer? You know, is it the next deadline even? I mean, that's
I have a hard time seeing it be all the way next deadline, to be honest.
Yeah, I've said that before too, but I think one thing that I would say is that a lot of Canucks fans have maybe got, I think a lot of people have overvalued maybe how much, you know, two cup runs with JT Miller is worth in a trade. I don't think other people are looking at that and saying, you know, it's as much as Canucks fans are asking for, and like, you know, all these New York trade proposals. So I mean, if it's not as much as we think it is, like, I wouldn't be surprised if Jim Rutherford, it's like, you know what, let's just keep this guy for next year, trade him at the deadline. It's going to be about the same deal you get this summer or the trade deadline next year. You know, maybe the team surprises him and, you know, they play well to start next season. Maybe they're contending for, you know, the top spot in the division. I'm not saying they will. Also, the roster's going to look entirely different than what it looks like right now, I'm guessing. So it's hard to say, but I mean, that's just one reason why I wouldn't be surprised if it's next year's deadline either.
Yeah, I kind of agree because, like, I think, well, the other thing that we're all forgetting here is that he's $5.25 million. Like, it's not a huge ticket for the production, but it's still a decent amount of the cap, right? So if you look at a team,
like, you take money back.
Yeah, like say Colorado or something, like, you know, they can't really afford to take on another $5 million next year, right? Whereas if it's at the deadline, you can eat half, maybe launder it through Arizona. All of a sudden that player becomes a $1.5 million player. That's a lot more digestible for a team to fit in, right? So I don't know. I kind of agree with Husa. It might not be until next year. It all depends.
Yeah, I just think that the value of typically in NHL, players get traded when they're a rental. You know, 1 year left in their contract, and then you know what that's worth. You know, it's a first round draft pick and a prospect, typically, depending on the value of how good the player is, right? It's very ambiguous what the value of a guy who's got 1.5 years left in his contract is. Like, what is that really worth? Because those trades don't happen that often. So it's like, how much more would I really be willing to pay? And I think teams are kind of getting skittish on that.
I mean, I think...
And I'm not really sure...
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. No, I was just saying, I don't think... Especially the Rangers. And I think the thing with the Rangers, people... Rangers Twitter has just gotten insane. I'm like, they don't want to give up any of their prospects, basically. I have a tough... I think that's different. I think they have a tough time deciding who... You know, I think they don't understand where their team is at in a competitive cycle right now. So that's why I think it's kind of hard for us to understand where they're coming from. Because, like, where else would JT Miller really land that another team would really, like, you know, drop their pants? We have to have JT Miller. Like, how many teams would look around the league right now and say, we need to have JT Miller? That's going to put us over the top for a Stanley Cup run this season. And how many teams are going to say that that couldn't say the same thing about Claude Giroux?
Well, that's the kicker, right, is that Claude Giroux's out there and... Yeah. You know, from everything we're hearing, it sounds like Colorado's the front runner to get Giroux. So that's why what I'm kind of meaning about that extra year, like Giroux's an expiring contract. So if you could launder him through Arizona and get him at 2.5, you know, then you don't have an extra cap commitment next year. Whereas if they take on JT Miller, they still have that on their books next year. Now you can argue who the better player is, but from a Colorado perspective, if you're looking at your next year's projection of a roster, you know, maybe you want to keep that cap space that you would spend on JT Miller open to see what else comes up in the market, right? Like, they got Devon Toews for free, basically, from the Islanders because they had cap room to take him on.
Yep.
The other thing I wanted to mention was about a JT Miller trade in the summer. JT Miller doesn't have any kind of trade protection. You don't have to trade him to a contender or a team of his choosing. You might find a team like the Canucks in 1920 when they traded for him that think are trying to accelerate their own process of getting just into the playoffs, or, you know, are, you know, a little eager to get, you know, I could look at a team like New Jersey. They seem to me like they're kind of eager to get going now, and they're not as far along as they would like, you know, which is why I think they had interest in Garland. So maybe you could sell them on a JT Miller like player. Like, you don't necessarily have to trade JT Miller to a contending team, right? Because he doesn't have any kind of protection. He has no leverage to force the trade anywhere he wants to go. So you can basically send him anywhere. So I would say even in the summer, you could try to identify a team that was like the Canucks when they played for JT Miller the first time.
Just one thing I would say, though, for why you might want to prefer moving JT Miller this trade deadline is that if you go and look at those center options, I'm going to focus on New York here especially, you know, they're a team that could really benefit from a second-line center. But then the drop-off from, you know, JT Miller is the best center on the market right now come this trade deadline, and the drop-off is – it's huge. The next guy you're going to be getting is nowhere near as good as JT Miller. But if you look at next year's trade deadline, and I just pulled this up right now, like a couple of UFAs, like there's going to be guys like Sean Monahan, Dylan Larkin. I'm not saying all these guys are going to get moved. Like, even a guy like Ryan O'Reilly, Timo Meier, like all these people are all going to be expiring contracts in that same summer. So, like, I'm not saying all of them are going to get traded for sure, but, you know, there's way more options compared to right now, where JT Miller is probably the best center on the market. So, I mean, that might be one reason why you're a little more eager to get him moved this summer, or not this summer, sorry, pardon me, this trade deadline.
Well, I think the concerning thing about Miller is that he got so good later on in his career, right? He turned into a 90-point player when he got to Vancouver, so it's only been like 3 seasons of this kind of production. He's not really that typical kind of player. You know, he was a first-round draft pick, but he's not really like a Claude Giroux or a high pedigree player who came in the NHL and has been dominant for a few seasons in a row now. Like, you know, you could talk yourself if you're another team being like, you know, JT Miller's a mirage on Vancouver on a bad team. Like, he's not really going to get that same opportunity on our team or whatever. So, I mean, I think that is something else that considers, like, when other teams are looking at a JT Miller trade. I think if you need to get a JT Miller trade, you need to really pick your – you need to find the perfect mark for Miller here. You need to look at a team that is desperate, that's going to pay you a lot, that's in the cup window right now, that would really drop their pants to get Miller. And I don't think that there's that many teams out there that are like that. Like, we look at, from a Canucks fan perspective, we go to, oh, who has the best prospect pool, and let's dump him there. But I don't think that is a that's always the best line of thinking, because I think the two teams that have the best prospect pools, the Rangers and the Wild, aren't necessarily the teams that are going to be the most hot and heavy after Miller, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, another team I think might be interested in is the LA Kings.
Okay, I can see where you're going there.
LA has, like, it's great to have prospects, but if you have, like, 15 prospects that you're thinking are going to make the team and be good players, like, there's only 20 roster spots, right? So you can't use all your prospects and wait for them to come to the league. They're going to have to move some. And you look at JT Miller, you know, LA makes a lot of sense to me. It checks a lot of boxes. It's a major U.S. city. You know, he won't be necessarily the, you know, number one athlete in town. He won't get all the attention in LA. He can play on a good team. You know, he can sort of be that leadership, mentorship role for guys like Turcotte and Byfield. His versatility to play center and wing can help LA. You know, I think LA is a team who's, in the next 2-3 years with all these guys on entry-level contracts, they're going to be able to make a run, right? They're going to be getting, like, a Quentin Byfield is going to give them $5-7 million worth of production for, you know, $1.5 million on the cap, right? So I think they have an opportunity with LA to move Miller there, just because a lot of the boxes fit. And I think from JT Miller's side, I think he'd be willing to entertain a contract in LA, which obviously would help the trade value. And, you know, a team's not going to trade for JT Miller, give up a bunch of assets if they know he's not going to resign with them.
I like the share in LA there. They're loaded on right shot defensemen as well, in terms of, they've got like 4 or 5 right shot deep prospects that, you know, are could be potentially available. And the thing about them is that Kopitar and Doughty are on huge tickets right now that aren't going to get moved, and they're actually having good seasons right now. Those guys aren't going to get moved. You might as well just take advantage of the time that they're actually still producing at an okay level. Or not okay level, like a good level, and then, you know, supplement the rest of your roster with those young prospects that they've got, and then add JT Miller type of player, and then maybe they can, they're teams that kind of got cap space, and maybe they're looking at like a Philip Forsberg type of added free agency, and then they could really make a run at it next year. So that might be a good target as well. Like, I think if you look at a guy like, they got like Tobias Bjornfoot down there, Brock Faber, obviously they got Brad Clark, which probably, who probably would be untouchable in a trade like this. But, you know, there's some options down there for sure.
Yeah, no, definitely. And like you said, you know, they have these players on big tickets. They're performing relatively well. They just added Philip Deneau. You know, like, they have a lot of high-priced players, so why not try to take advantage of this ELC window and see what happens, right? Like, that's the thing we always give the Canucks.
That's kind of what we wanted the Canucks to do a few years ago.
Like, you know, they got $10 million in value from Pettersson his first couple years, and they didn't do anything with it, right? So if I'm LA, like, you know, depending on the cost, like, would I be willing to give up a Brock Faber and, say, a protected first-round pick? Probably. Right. It might take a little bit more from the Canucks side, but that's a general framework where you can make something work and try to squeeze in, you know, a couple of playoff runs and see what happens. Right. The other thing too is the Pacific division is so weak right now. So weak. And you look at the Central, they're a strong division, Metropolitan, strong division, right? Like, for a team to add JT Miller, who's maybe not quite in their window, like, I don't see the Rangers fit as much, because I don't think the Rangers are going to be able to beat some combination of Florida, Tampa, Carolina, and Toronto, right, to get through to the finals. Whereas LA, whoever they play in the first round, as long as it's not Vegas, probably an easy W. Second round, you know, you can...
Well, could run to Calgary. They could run to Calgary this season.
Calgary for sure. Calgary's a wild card. But I mean, like, I just, when I look at the Pacific division and the path to the Stanley Cup final, I'm really scared of is Colorado, Vegas, and Calgary. And I look in the East and I can name 6 teams that I would be afraid of playing. So again, I think LA is a team where if they decide to make a few moves, you know, I can see a bigger payoff for them.
Yeah, for sure. Go ahead, Ames.
I was going to say, especially like Andy saying, you know, if you get JT Miller for more than, you know, 1 playoff run, if you're LA, you know, I look at Calgary too, like, this offseason, they're going to make a lot of tough decisions. Like, they're probably not going to be as good as they are this season. So, you know, like you look a little farther ahead, and, you know, even next year, that's another team off the Western Conference that you're even less scared of. And it really only comes back down to Vegas and Colorado.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. Like, I mean, I think that LA might be a destination that's kind of off the radar. That might be a good fit. But I think that's what I'm saying. It's like you really got to think hard about what you could get, where you would want to move JT Miller to if you really want to win this trade, is what I was trying to say. But yeah, I think LA is a good shout there for sure. And I think kind of outlined a lot of the reasons that would make sense for both parties.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's going to be interesting what happens with Miller, because I think if the Canucks play this right, JT Miller is a guy who can really take this team from having to tear it down again to, you know, being competitive in 18 months, right? So
yeah,
I think the biggest thing, like you said earlier, is not necessarily target a position, but make sure you maximize the value and then gain those assets. And then it, you know, it gives you more chips to play with at the table, right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's an interesting discussion, but it's also kind of frustrating because you look at it, like, if this last offseason was pretty damaging to the Canucks long-term. Like, the Canucks have really painted themselves in a corner now, and it's very going to be very, very difficult to navigate their way out of it. It's going to take some very creative moves. It's going to take some, you know, cap flexibility. It's going to take a lot of, you know, really, really smart talent acquisition that I think that, you know, you need to take advantage of some other teams with. And it's, you know, I think, yeah, I just think it's going to be really, really tough. And I think there are some opportunities that maybe I think we're not even thinking about doing that. I think maybe if you could move Miller for like another higher salary defenseman on a team that's looking to shed salary and create space. I don't know. Maybe there is something like that. I don't know. I'm just kind of like thinking out loud here. Like, you think that there's a fit in Colorado with JT Miller, and maybe we was taking like a guy like Sam Girard back, who I know that they've kind of fallen out of love with, who's on a pretty reasonable, big ticket, but pretty reasonable for a team like Vancouver. He's young, he fits the window. The only thing is, again, left-handed, smaller D-man, maybe not the skill set you're looking for, but would there be a basis of a trade there or anything like that? I was just kind of kicking it around. It would make the salary more palatable. It would maybe potentially make it easier. We could even retain salary in that situation. Maybe it would make more palatable for Colorado to re-sign Kadri if they want to in this offseason. I don't know.
That was actually something I was just going to bring up real quick. How you were talking, how you guys were all mentioning, you know, regardless of JT Miller, you know, let's not focus on position. Let's just take, you know, as much value and as many assets back as we can. Let's say the Canucks make a trade and, you know, whether it's Sam Girard or it's Nils Lundqvist or something like that, it's a left-handed D-man is what I'm getting at here. Okay.
Nils Lundqvist is right-handed.
Is he right-handed? I thought he plays left side though.
He's a right-handed.
Lundqvist is a lefty.
He's a right shot, though.
Oh, okay. That makes that a lot better. I don't know why. I thought he was left. I was under the impression that he was left-handed for most of this.
He's
okay.
Small.
Okay, maybe
hockey,
maybe
if hockey DB lists him as a right shot. I don't know if that.
Yeah. He's right-handed.
All right. Well, maybe it's not him, but let's say the Canucks get back like a nice left-handed defensive prospect. It's like a team's top, maybe not top, you know, like top two, three defensive prospect. He's left-handed, and now out of a combination of Hoglander, Rathbone, and Podkolzin, you entertain the idea of maybe moving one or two of them with Oliver Ekman-Larsson to free up the money? Because a lot of the reason why I see people are saying let's not bring back a left-handed defenseman for a JT Miller trade is, you know, you have Quinn Hughes, you have Ekman-Larsson here, and you have Jack Rathbone. You know, like, where's this, you know, the piece going to fit? But if you're making Oliver Ekman-Larsson expendable, maybe at the cost of two of the three names I just mentioned there, is that something you're going to entertain to move Ekman-Larsson?
I don't even think that those pieces would get Ekman-Larsson done.
What do you think it is then?
I don't think the Canucks have any sort of asset that could move.
No asset.
Ekman-Larsson?
Not even a first round pick and a combination of some of those?
Maybe that.
And just maybe.
I don't think there's any team in the NHL could absorb
the
a $7.25 million.
The only team that could afford Ekman-Larsson's contract is Arizona, and they just traded that contract because they don't want to pay him.
Exactly.
Would you entertain the idea of retaining salary to move Ekman-Larsson?
No.
Or would you just
7 years of retained salary for a guy?
I mean, is it not better than just having him at his full
capacity anyway? I would just keep him for now, and hopefully he gets some kind of he's old. Your really only hope is that he retires before the contract ends or that he gets LTIR'd?
Yeah.
Ace to say he hopes that he gets injured, but he's...
No. I didn't say that. No, don't put words on that. I never said that I hope he gets injured. I would never...
He gets allergic to like Marian Hossa.
Like maybe he's gets a little equipment. Who knows?
Yeah.
About you know one I think I mentioned this last podcast too. An idea I'm not opposed to is using some of these players to create more cap room. You know what I mean? Like, let's say you trade Garland, maybe you take a bit less on the return, but you move out Pullman in the process. Is that, you know, it's less than ideal, but is that something you
that's like so consider? That's so tough for me because it's like the Canucks, like we mentioned, have so the Canucks have only a few good players, right? You're getting rid of one of them to create, you know, get assets back, and you're ruining the value of that guy to create the cap space. I understand cap space can do a lot of things right now in case of flexibility, but it would be so difficult for us to get better at the same time without just having that cap flexibility. Because then it's like, okay, maybe we can, you would maybe just want to sit like that. Then maybe you can pull off like a Devon Taves trade or something like that because you have the flexibility to do it. But that's such an ambiguous notion at this point. So it's just really hard for me to get behind that. But it's also probably the only way you can get out of those kind of contracts that we have signed right now. Like how many unmovable contracts do the Canucks even have right now? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, like I said, I think there's only one bad contract the Canucks have that you can move without a sweetener or any attachment, and it's Tanner Pearson. That's it. Everybody else probably requires something attached to them. Maybe Jason Dickinson doesn't, but I mean, we just shredded him for like 15 minutes to start this podcast. So, I mean, I would say like even he's probably...
Andy, like what would you say? Like you could attach Dickinson to Garland, and like what would you give, you know, which contract would you attach with him to get rid of him?
Probably Pullman just because he has the most term remaining. You know, Dickinson, I think Hoos is right. You can probably convince somebody to take him for, you know, not much, or you take a contract back. OEL, obviously you'd want to move, but we just said nobody's in their right minds taking that contract. So I think Pullman's the one you'd try to move. I mean, he's signed for another 3 years at, you know, 2.5 isn't a huge cap hit, but you can find a good third line center for $2.5 million. So I think by moving Pullman, it gives you enough flexibility and options to make your team better without, you know, completely decimating what remaining assets you have.
I think I'd like to make a trade like Pullman, Garland, and Dickinson in New Jersey with Zaka going back to replace Dickinson, and then like Severson and a prospect or something like that. Like even a Ty Smith just to get the cap space. I think that trade would be a W, absolute W for the Canucks if you could pull something like that.
I'm not sure if the Devils would take that though.
The Devils want NHL bodies and they want people who have term.
Well, the thing with New Jersey, right, is that they're kind of the third choice in that area of, you know, the tri-state area, right? Like people would rather obviously play for the Rangers. The Islanders have a new building. They seem to be, other than this year, a pretty good team. Like the problem the Devils have is they can't find free agents.
Yeah.
Or if they do, they have to massively overpay, right? So if you can get a Jason Dickinson who has some term left to kind of replace Zaka, you know, I think that's something they'd be interested in just because it's cost certainty, right? Like to find those guys from New Jersey is kind of like Winnipeg, where it's so expensive and hard to find them. You almost have to sort of, you know, kind of lose a trade, I guess, just to get bodies in the door.
Absolutely.
Yeah, no.
I think that might be an interesting avenue to explore. But I mean, to get back to your larger question, would I move Garland? Would I take less return on some of the good assets the Canucks have to create cap space? I think I have to say yes, but it would be tough. Depending, it really depends. It's like a case by case situation. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think I would do that for a JT Miller trade. Would I do it for a Connor Garland trade? Perhaps.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? Connor Garland's only the big one out of those four names that we've been kind of talking about the whole time that I would do it for. I think even for Brock Besser, Brock Besser's contract situation itself already makes it a little harder to move him. So, like, I don't think that many teams would be, you know, lining up for Brock Besser attached to, you know, Pullman or Hamnick or whoever.
Yeah.
Play, to be honest. And I'd say one thing, though, for sure about Connor Garland, though, if you're to attach him with a contract, with, like, let's just say it's Pullman, 2.5 plus the 5 Connor Garland's making, you know, that's not like a cheap amount of money. You know, that's like
$7. You just got a lot of cap space, though. You would take back Zaka, $28 or whatever.
That definitely limits your options of teams that can take him. You know, you have to find a team that has the cap space. And if not, you know, like you guys said, it's money coming back for the Canucks anyway.
Yeah, I think the idea of getting money back is that you have either somebody you can buy out/move again, or you have less term. right? Because right now with another 3 years on Pullman, like that's just killing you because he's a basically a sixth or seventh defenseman for another 3 years, right? So if you can move him and get Zacha back and say you have to keep him for 1 year on his QO, at least that sets you up in the shorter term to be able to be more flexible.
Or does not even qualify. I mean, just let him go to undership free agency. You really want to cast space? What difference does it make?
Exactly.
Yeah, or there's a chance
if Zaka's not a fit, or if you there's a chance he comes in and he's, you know, doing really well, and then if you be like, hey, let's sign with a, you know, 3 or 4 year contract instead.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Anyway, I think we can wrap the episode here. Unless anyone else had anything they really want to get into. Predictions for tonight's game versus Seattle?
Doesn't really matter. That's my prediction.
Exactly.
The playoff race, Ace.
Yeah, exactly. 4-2 Canucks, baby. If they win tonight, they're making the playoffs. I'll bet my house on it.
Okay.
Good thing you don't know the house.
Yeah. I'm going to say we're about to become homeless.
Yeah, I think the Canucks should probably win this game. I think the last couple games, they haven't played the best. Seattle's obviously a terrible team. I think the Canucks will win. I don't know.
You're a hot take. If the Canucks don't give up 5 goals in the first period, they should probably win this game.
Exactly.
That's why you pay the big bucks for that kind of analysis.
Oh, really? Yeah. I could totally get on TV and really break it down with Ron McLean and Hockey Night in Canada.
You and Caleb, eh?
Yeah.
Right on. Ace, you did say one? Or did Andy, when you guys were saying something?
No, I was just saying Seattle's not very good, so the Canucks should win.
All right. 5-1 Canucks. 5-1, baby. Take it to the bank. Patterson, anytime goal scorer also?
Yeah, free money.
You know what? I think after the way Demko played, was it 2 games ago or last game when he got pulled?
Yeah, last game. Yeah, with the Ducks,
I think he bounces back. Seattle's not a high scoring team. I'll say Demko shutout.
Nice.
I like that.
Okay, too. I was gonna ask Ace for music here, but I forgot we're on Zoom and I don't have it, so I'll just start reading the intro and Ace will fix it after. Thanks for listening to another week, everyone. Find us on all your major podcasting platforms, Apple, Spotify, iHeartRadio, wherever you get your podcasts, just look up Capspace to Wins Cups. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Capspace Cups. We're super interactive, so check us out. If you don't listen to Rebel iTunes, please go to Apple iTunes and leave us a 5-star review because
I'm a 5-star man.
It really helps with the show. Also, go check out all the other great content on the Area 51 Sports Network, Point Shot Hockey, Canucks Mafia, The Third Line Podcast, Terminal City FC, The UFO Show, Van Slam, and Fantastic Writing. It is your home for Vancouver sports content. That's all we got for this week's episode. Talk to you all next week.
Vancouver selects from the University of Michigan, Quinn Hughes.
From Timrå, Elias Peterson.
From Waterloo of the USHL, Brock Besser.
From the London Knights of the Canadian Hockey League, Bo Horvat.
To the Tampa Bay Lightning in exchange for JT Miller.
Thatcher Demko with an amazing 43-save performance says, let's play Game 6.
Ladies and gentlemen, please make some noise and welcome the 14th captain of your Vancouver Canucks.
Score! Niels Höglander, it's time to hand out the sweets.
Enjoy the future, folks. Here's